My question is this, though. So what was the young Svensson like? Who was this guy? Because obviously you get, there's a weird connection where you team up with him years later. So what was he like as a younger guy?
Yeah, he was really the ultimate embodiment of the keyboard warrior, where he was extremely toxic online. He told me things that I definitely cannot say in this interview. But then when you meet him in person, he's like really shy. He's a super nice guy. He's really caring. He cares about other people's feelings. He's very helpful. So it was just a complete contrast. And DeFizio told me that too. He's like, you know, Svensson, he tries to do his best to look like a tough guy online, but when you meet him in person, he's like an angel. So it was really hard to kind of disconnect those two people, the online persona that I had met with the Svensson that I met in person. And that's also kind of been a storyline when Svensson joined TSM in 2016, 2017, when none of the fans, there hasn't been much content of Dennis on the internet. So they didn't know how he was as a person. They only knew about the Taipei story. So they just assumed that he was an asshole and that he was like really arrogant at things. And now that there's actually been TSM Legends and interviews and he's gotten more exposure, people can see kind of what his real person is. I think he needed that outlet. Online, maybe similar to what you said before, it's kind of like instead of talking shit in real life, you would just talk shit online. And I think he was very much like that. But in person, he was a super nice guy.
Because the thing is, in the early days, I think he even admitted this in his reflections. In the early days, he did oversell that aspect where he always used to say that, like, you know, I found Bjergsen in relegations. You know, he made it sound as though, like, you know, he found you in the trash. And he's like, he like polished it off, like, oh, this could be good one day. Even though, like, everyone in Europe was like, come on, mate, we have just watched this guy play for like two splits. He was pretty good in Europe and, you know, his team took the first split and he had these issues in the second split. What did you ever think when Reginald used to say that? Because he did make it sound like you were sort of a failure and he picked you up for TSM.
I mean, I don't know. I was in talks with some other teams at the time too. Actually, I was talking to Curse at that time as well because I really wanted to be in a gaming house, especially because that's something I never had with Copenhagen Wolves and NIP. I don't know about Andy discovering me. I think in terms of NA, wasn't very aware of what was happening in the EU LCS. So in that sense, he kind of felt like maybe he discovered me because a lot of the NA players hadn't really heard of me. Andy probably didn't really hear of me until maybe the end of the split at NIP, and definitely the NA fans, a lot of them hadn't heard of me. So I think in his own little bubble, it felt like he discovered me, but like you said, in the grand scheme of things, I had been playing for a bit and there were other people recognizing my talent, even though I think I was still a very unstable player at the time.
Is there anyone who's Danish who in CSGO is as good in CSGO as Trace was in 1.6?
I think if you look at a player, you have to go for Device. Device is capable of orbing, which Trace was as well. I just think Device is more bigger player in area aspect. He's like more complete player, I would say, than okay. Trace was. He's a better teammate, I think. He's all that kind of stuff where I think Trace was heavily reliable on his aim and his positioning compared to Device, who can do everything for the team.
Was Trace a rager? Was that true, that rep that he had?
It was hard for me to say from outside, but what I've heard, he had a very specific personality, and I know that from back in the days as well, that he is kind of hard to deal with, but if you're able to deal with it, just so it's fine, I guess. So I wouldn't say he's a rager, but he has a specific way of being as a person, and if you get along with it, you get along with it. If not, then you have a problem.
Now, here's what I want to know. How were you able to beat MTW, but then go to this tournament and lose in what is probably the most pathetic WCG group ever? Like, it's not like you played, you know, the Poles or something. You actually lost, if you remember. There was a team from Romania, and there was a team from Spain. Spain, that was the other one.
There was one more team as well.
There's some other team, but who even cares, right? How did that happen? How can you beat MTW one week and then lose to these teams the next?
I mean, first of all, to actually comment on the WCG qualifier, we won the WCG qualifier, and I think it was like a Danish company was investing heavy money, taking documentary movie makers to show esports to Denmark. And we won. And then
some sort of steel company, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Dansk Steel, Matt, yeah. Ultimate. Yeah, okay.
Don't crash my Skype again. I speak Danish.
Okay.
No, it came to that situation that we actually won. The MTW wouldn't go. Then suddenly, they got one more spot. So when you started to qualify, you only had one spot. Yeah. But because we won the final, MTW didn't go.
I'm pretty sure there would have been no second spot for you if you'd have lost.
One more spot to get two Danish teams because they thought that would be good. And when we came to WCG, it was a worst tournament in my life, I think I've been part of it. Like, we were so hyped, we got a good group, and basically we played this Romanian guys on Tuscan, and they kept us rushing us, and we just lost every single duel, and we end up somehow by losing 16-8 or something like that. You actually had to play all rounds.
30.
Yeah, with 22-8 or something like that. And then the next day, we play against the eventual group winners on train and win 26-4. Mm-hmm. And in the end, we have to play the most important match against the Spanish guys, and we lose us 16-2, and then we just left the server because we're out of tournament. It was
classic. Okay.
Yeah, it was like one of the whole best events I ever had in 1.6, where you came in all with this hype and you were ready to actually go to playoff and maybe even top four because we really felt we had a good team back then.
Right. Even though that was 3-0 though, Jankos, I have a question about this series, because I remember game one of this series, you played Olaf, and dude, you got like 7 kills or something, man. You were like carrying the early game, but the problem with your team obviously had issues with like mid game and shot call and stuff. In the second game, I remember it was really close for a while. Like, even though this was a 3-0, I wondered from your personal perspective, like, were you just a different player back then? Like, the Jankos, I feel like now, if a Jankos was on an Olaf now and he got like 7 or 8 kills, you would get a laner ahead, you'd carry the game. Do you remember what it was like? Do you remember what went wrong for you?
I mean, I think what mostly went wrong is that the map play was so much better and how they played with control was different. I think that, of course, a team right now from 2023 would beat that team in 2015. We didn't have to, like, world champions back then were very good at the game. I mean, the concept of the game was different. Junglers had worked, so, like, again, the game worked much, much different. But just overall, I would say that their map play was so much more solid. Like, they understood better how to put vision, how to make their laners safe, how to get their pushouts, how to secure an objective, how to group for it. And sure, you could have kills, but it wasn't as simple to like carry the game, because it's not like you just go and fist fight each other who is better, right? It's more about concept. It's more about map play. And this is something that back then Western teams did worse. And we still do worse, actually. It's still the same thing where side laning is better for Eastern teams. And I think the best side lane team from Europe was G2 in 2019, where we were actually better at side laning. And we were beating Eastern teams with side lanes. We didn't have lead every game. We actually often started from behind. But then when mid game came through and we had, you know, perks and caps, sometimes Wunder, sometimes caps on side lanes, we would play very, very well, and we had a good understanding of it, so then we would beat the Eastern teams. This is the only way you can learn. This is the only way you can compete long-term against Eastern teams, because if you never take risks and no one is challenging you, let's say you are Cloud9 and you are destroying everyone in NA, no one is challenging you, and then you go and you face GNG, and then you just get like 3-0'd, and you just get destroyed. And like, there is just no competition. Like, there's no game where you are competitive. You are just getting spanked. You are just getting made fun of. So... And G2 was very, very competitive, I think, in both the series against BLG, and I think in Gen G some games they're competitive too, because they're willing to take those risks and because they have good laners to and good junglers who, like, all of them, good individual players who can, like, kind of make the game playable. You also need, I guess, good enough players to make the game playable. If you are getting destroyed during the laning phase, there's, like, nothing to play for. But if you can make the laning phase somewhat relevant, you lose one lane, you win the last one is even, you get to play the game, you get to play the map, and you actually play the map, right? You are not afraid of them to take the fights, to bait them, to kind of beat them on their own game. I think many analysts have opinions that West should just cheese and should, like, come out with shots, like, out of the picture and have, like, original picks. I think that's great to do for a game, but I don't think there is, like, a strat where you can, like, 3-0 on an Asian team by cheesing every game and playing original champions, because the idea of these cheese champions is that they are trash. They are not good. That's why they are not being played. So sure, maybe you can find a champion that is very out of the meta and very OP, but try to find them like multiple times over multiple BO5 so that you can like keep cheesing and winning, right? I still think you need to be solid enough to be good enough at you know the same concepts of the game to beat Eastern teams. So I think that you know, you need to be willing to take risks and you need to be willing to learn over time.
The NA teams, though, that I remember was the main core that most people will know was the Dynamic team. Now, yep. What was the rationale behind how you moved around these teams? Because it seems like some of the players are some of the ones you tried to get like later in CSGO for Talked, etc. Some people you're familiar with then. But the Team Dynamic team, I know, was one of the ones that had a lot of success. So what was like your first big introduction to the competitive side of things, going to the big lands, not just local Canadian ones?
So I was always trying to like punch above my weight the entire way through. 6 months into playing competitively, I'm trying to go to all the local Toronto events, all the Montreal-based events, so the ETS, the Core LAN, Atlanta Paloozas, anything I could really play at, I'd try to go there. But then I'd also try to like play with other players that were better than me so I could learn from them and just kind of absorb everything I could like a sponge. So I was trying to play like all the roles. I was trying to learn everything from what I could and try to play and get as much experience as I could. And then I think like every time I learned a little bit, I tried to go too far, like almost like Icarus. I would fly too high, get too close to the sun, then fall. So basically every time like I played with other people that, you know, I learned a lot from, but I wasn't good enough to cut it. Like I would get cut from that team or something like that. And then I'd go back and play with my older friends, bring to them what I learned. And then we would improve as a team a little bit. And then we were able to make it to the next division and the next division.
Right. At one point you actually had Dazed for an event. You had him for an ESWC event, which at the time, I mean, that was a big deal, by the way, for Source, for people who don't know, to get kind of one of the majors to support the game. So this was a very big tournament. And obviously it's one that you do well at. You came third.
Yeah.
What the fuck was Dazed like in Source? Was he at all like he is now? What was he like to play with at the time?
So I haven't really spoken to him too much these days, so I don't know. Like I can't say now what is he like versus like, you know, 2 years ago or like back on Ibit Power. The very first time I met him was my very first ESEA LAN, and I didn't know anyone at the time. I was like, this is my first ESEA LAN. I'm going up to people and introducing myself. I'm like, hey guys, I'm Steel. My name's Josh. Like I would go up and introduce myself, and then I go up to Dazed, and he's like, I'm not shaking your hand. Okay. Okay, then.
So one player I want to talk about at the beginning is, I've noticed a trend in most esports games, which is early on when the mechanics aren't refined, Koreans haven't had a chance to get every build order down to the microsecond and know every opening and everything. At that point in the game, the skill that is obviously the most abundantly useful is to be super creative, to be the guy who can just intuitively do things. Your big brain, basically. It's not so much about hands, it's about the brain. That's why Boxer in the early days of StarCraft Brood War. So to me, the player I thought that exemplified that in the early days of StarCraft 2 was Nesty, because this is someone where once it did become about mechanics and he had to know, then he fell off, then he was just an okay player. But this guy in the early days, he was a genius, right?
Yeah, I sure thought so. Nesty was, he was the oldest champion that we ever really got, right? Like he won a championship when he was already 30 years old, which is like unheard of in Korea, unheard of. Although we're probably going to enter that territory again really soon in StarCraft 2 as the players are coming back from military. But yeah, in that time, that was an insane thing to see. And the thing is, he was actually like really figuring out what to actually do with Zerg, because we had some early greatness from like Fruit Dealer with that first win. That was amazing. And like he just kind of pulled that out of nowhere. And like Aydra was super strong in the early days and everything. But they really both kind of paled in comparison to what Nesty pulled off with 3 GSL victories. It took so many years for anyone to catch that with the Zerg race. 2v2 is giving you so much information about the fundamentals of the game. It's like so many early units running into each other over and over and over that it reminded me of this thing like, you know, you're not supposed to talk about him, but Savior, you know, the one Zerg bone joy that we ever had, was a 2v2 player for a little bit as well. And he became the greatest Zerg that we had in Brood War, up to the point where, you know, obviously he had that whole betting scandal and everything. But like there's something there, I think, about spending that extra time on the very fundamental aspects that helped both of these players become the absolute best of their time periods. And yeah, I mean, Nesty was I loved it, man. Like he was taller than everyone. He was smarter than everyone. He was older than everyone. And he won more championships than everyone except like MVP in that era. So He was like a really special player, I thought. He was the player I had the most fun casting, for sure.
I've been pleasantly surprised during the time I've had my Patreon and my Patreon community, the Skrilluminati, by both the financial support they've provided and the moral support. And so this video was kindly supported and made possible by Starlust, Theo Buenzelli, Ahmed Haju, Matt Pugnaccio Racula, Toucan, Jensen Gore, Animosity, Tobias Bernasconi, Bot Pounder 420, Yurka 86, Tosh, and as always, you know it, a special thanks goes out to my main man, Jerky's Minion. Would you like to ask a question in one of those AMAs where I tend to go pretty in-depth? Sometimes they even spin out into their own videos. Do you want teasers to find out who the upcoming guests are for the myriad of interviews that I do across esports? Maybe you want to suggest a topic or a guest? We have a channel on my Discord where you can do that if you're at the right tier. And of course, you could potentially take part in one of those lengthy esports discussions with me about whatever is on your mind in the scene. Well, if any of those perks sound tantalizing, put your money where your mouth is and join the Skrilluminati today via the Patreon link in the description box below.